I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. The General Assembly will wrap up its session in less than 3 weeks. What bills still have a chance to pass? What's the effect of testy exchanges between the Republican governor and Democratic leaders? We talk politics and legislation this hour with commentator Barry Raskovar and WIPR State House reporter Rachel Bay. What will happen to the Justice Reinvestment Act, a bipartisan effort to save money and reduce the state's prison population? After amendments, some doubt whether the bill accomplishes meaningful reform. And in the shadow of canceling Baltimore's Red Line, who will set and enforce priorities for transportation projects? Plus, Maryland's state song and motto, tax cuts, college scholarships for middle schoolers, and more. That's Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for tuning in today. Today we're looking at the General Assembly. We've got just under 3 weeks until the end of the legislative session on April 11th. 2 days ago was crossover day, the last day for bills to pass in the House where they were first introduced. An enormous range of bills has been introduced in this legislature, from proposals for pay equity for women and the ability for terminally ill patients to receive aid in dying, to changes to the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights and limits to standardized testing in schools. In early February, Governor Larry Hogan struck a bipartisan tone in his State of the State address. Standing in the state legislature, he told lawmakers, quote, "There is so much more that unites us than that which divides us," close quote, and ask that they seek the middle ground where we can all stand together. But those aren't the headlines we've been seeing out of Annapolis. Democratic lawmakers criticized the governor's budget, asking, where's the beef? In a radio interview, Governor Hogan compared legislators to college students on spring break. Reacting to plans to fund the construction of a new jail in Baltimore before buildings at historically black colleges, members of the Legislative Black Caucus accused the governor of neglecting black residents. In this hour of Midday, we'll take a look at what has survived the chopping block in Annapolis and what hasn't, and what that means for Marylanders. Later this hour, we'll talk about the Justice Reinvestment Act, a lengthy bipartisan bill that aims to reduce the state's prison population with changes to sentencing, parole, and the supervision of offenders. The Senate gave preliminary approval to that act this morning. Up first, though, a package of bills in Baltimore to cover the demolition of vacant houses, tax credits for those who rehab vacants, police reforms, and much more. With me in the studio is Barry Raskovar, political commentator and blogger at politicalmaryland.com. Welcome back, Barry.
It's always a pleasure, Sheila.
It's always a pleasure to have you. And also with us, Rachel Bay, WIPR State House reporter. Thanks for hanging out with us here at WIPR.
My pleasure.
Taking an hour or so off from Annapolis. Let's talk about these Baltimore bills. Barry, you wrote a column this week saying that leadership has been lacking, that there hasn't been a vision for how Baltimore should rebuild itself after what happened almost a year ago, the riot.
It's been almost a year, and we still have yet to see a long-term recovery plan coming out of City Hall, nor have we seen a long-term recovery plan coming from the governor's office. And you would think one or the other or both would have done it by now. It's one of these curious things. So into the void has stepped the House Speaker and the Senate President with a package of bills to try to jumpstart the renewal of Baltimore. And it's aimed to a large extent at young people, trying to make sure that they can get a good education, that there are programs available for them in their spare time so they don't get into trouble. And it goes on and on. But it's kind of odd because the state legislature is the last place you'd expect a package like that to be created.
Why the last place? It is the state legislature, and Baltimore is the biggest city in the state.
Yes, but they don't have the resources. They don't have the research capabilities and the expertise that the governor and his cabinet have in order to formulate a long-range comprehensive plan for renewal for Baltimore. And the same thing with the mayor. You'd think by now that City Hall would have come up with an approach, a 5 or 10 year approach for Baltimore to really create a Phoenix-like revival in the city. But you haven't seen that anywhere.
Well, wait a minute. I could imagine that if Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, who took herself out of the running to continue as mayor, who decided not to seek re-election, if she came forth with a grand vision that would cost a fair amount of money, it would be considered dead on arrival. It would be, who's she? She's a lame duck. Why should we listen to what her vision is
for
Baltimore?
But now we'll never know if she had a vision. There's nothing coming out of City Hall. Neither the City Council nor the mayor is doing anything envisioning, if you will. So there's no leadership there per se. They're just waiting for the next mayor, which I think is a real mistake. And at the same time, you would think the governor would have been able to formulate a plan for the state to step in with some ideas on how to revive Baltimore, but that has not been forthcoming except for the vacant housing initiative that he put on the table. But you know, that's questionable as to how much new money is actually in that. So Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Michael Bush have come forward with a program which seems to be rolling along pretty well in Annapolis. And it could be on the governor's desk before too long.
This is a program with a total cost of almost $300 million.
Yes, but it's spread over 5 years, and it ends in 5 years. So the fiscal impact on the state is quite limited. So, you know, it's something to get the ball rolling, if you will, in Baltimore City. Unfortunately, the governor has not seen this as something where he can sit down and have his people work with the legislature to formulate a broader plan, a plan that may incorporate some of his cabinet officials' own ideas. It's just not there.
Rachel Bate, tell us from your perspective as a reporter covering the legislature, the package that Barry's just been talking about that was generated by Senate President Miller and House Speaker Bush. What does that look like coming out of the legislature? Does it seem to have a lot of momentum? What's in it, and how does it compare to other legislation that the General Assembly is considering having to do with Baltimore?
Well, this is really a group of disparate bills that are coming from different members of the General Assembly. It's not so much a cohesive package. So as a result, there are different pieces that are kind of moving along at different points in the policymaking process down there. So, for example, you do have one bill that came from Senator Ferguson from Baltimore that puts in law the money for the demolition that you were talking about, for a 5 year period of tearing down houses in certain parts of Baltimore.
Let me just interrupt, because there were kind of two pieces to that. After the governor had his bulldozer press conference that was early January,
mm-hmm.
And talked about his plan to demolish vacants, there was no money in the first. The first budget that he sent to the legislature did not include money for that. So then at some point, that money was added in a supplemental request, correct?
Well, so he in a supplemental request, he submitted 2 years of the 5-year program. So he backfunded the current fiscal year and also added money for next fiscal year. The goal, and what he has said he plans to do, is to fund $75 million of demolition for a 5-year period. So there's 3 more years left in that 5-year period that have not been funded. And the city would then contribute also just shy of $20 million toward that demolition. And that's just the tearing down side of things. And then he's proposed all sorts of different financial incentives to bring in private investment to take care of the rebuilding side of the program.
And then Senator Ferguson would go further and lock in funding for future years.
Yes. So this bill, which has already passed, the House version of the bill by Delegate Hammond, has already passed the House and is now, so this bill is now making its way through the Senate. And it it locks in for the five-year period demolition money. And there's another bill, also Delegate Hammond in the House and Senator Ferguson in the Senate, that has also passed the House and is moving along kind of side by side with this bill that offers reinvestment money for a lot of neighborhoods in Baltimore, not necessarily the same neighborhoods where the vacants are being torn down, but some of the examples of neighborhoods that Senator Ferguson mentioned to me were actually in South Baltimore, which is not necessarily where a lot of the vacants are being torn down. But the idea is that, you know, you need to both tear down the vacant houses that are kind of an eyesore in a lot of neighborhoods in Baltimore, and that are hotbeds for crime. But then you also need to be bringing new private investment into the city.
So you said there are a lot of bills dealing with Baltimore, but there is this particular package from Miller and Bush for a lot of reinvestment. It's perhaps more than reinvestment. It's after school and summer programs. It's keeping the city's libraries open longer, grants to community groups to develop blighted city areas. What are some of the other particular elements of that package?
I think you hit on most of them. What is interesting here is that the governor is taking an arm's distance relationship to this, whereas in prior years, if something like this popped up in the legislature, the governor's people would try to step in and massage and amend these bills so that they might be broader. And the bills may not fully recognize what's available on the state level that could be used in the city. The governor's cabinet officials are not deeply involved in discussions with Democratic legislators from the city. And that's one of the problems we're having in Annapolis. There's this dissonance between the second floor of the state house and the first floor of the state house in which there's a lack of communications.
Second floor being the governor's office, first floor being the legislature. Yes. You're deeply inside the bubble. That is Barry Raskavar, columnist and political commentator here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us here is Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for WIPR. What do you think about Barry's assertion that there's a lack of vision from the city and from the governor's office about what ought to happen in Baltimore? You can join this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Rachel, what are some of the you talked about the funding. What are some other bills that you think particularly have an impact in Baltimore that are considered Baltimore bills?
Yes. Yeah, so this package, like I said, it came from a number of different legislators and are kind of in different parts of the process. There are a few that have made it through crossover day and are continuing on. There are a couple of education bills that are really interesting. There's one which provides funding for extended school days and also summer programs. So you alluded to that. That's from Delegate McIntosh, also a Baltimore legislator. And this would actually not, it's part of what the Speaker's office is pushing as the Baltimore package, but it actually would affect 8 different jurisdictions around the state. Any jurisdiction where more than half of the public school students come from low-income households. And then also in those same jurisdictions, there's another education bill that, also from Delegate McIntosh, that creates a kind of a pipeline to college starting in 7th or 8th grade. So what it does is 7th or 8th grade students are able to apply for this mentorship program that takes them all through high school, and also to pre-qualify in 7th or 8th grade before they even get to high school, pre-qualify for a low-income scholarship to college in any public university in Maryland. So that allows them to really know that they can be striving to go to college.
And again, is that specific to Baltimore, or does that apply in other jurisdictions?
No, that also applies to any jurisdiction where more than half of public school students are coming from low-income households. That's the estimated about 8 jurisdictions in the state.
That's the eight jurisdictions. We need to take a quick break here. Lots more to talk about legislation affecting Baltimore and the rest of the state. And when we come back, we want to focus in particular on how a bipartisan effort to save the state $250 million over 10 years seems to be shrinking. We're going to look at the Justice Reinvestment Act. You can join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Everybody, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this hour about what the state legislature is focusing on in its final few weeks. I'm here with Rachel Bay, WIPR State House reporter, and Barry Raskovar, political commentator and blogger at politicalmaryland.com. And I want to focus now on the Justice Reinvestment Act, which certainly arrived as the very model of a bipartisan bill. Barry, would you remind us what the origins were for this effort, this bipartisan effort to basically reorganize how the state does criminal justice?
Well, the Pew Foundation did a study that basically found that Maryland was way behind other states as far as their criminal justice system is concerned, locking up people far too long for relatively minor offenses. So you have a package of ideas wrapped into a bill which is trying to reduce the number of people who are in prison or jails for relatively minor offenses so that the focus could be on the hardened criminals, if you will. That's the idea.
And the idea is, if you reduce the number of people and the number of days they are spending incarcerated, you save a lot of money that could then be reinvested in services
and alternatives to prison.
Alternatives and things that would tend to keep people out of going to prison
Yes, trying to reduce what they call the recidivism rate, which is the return rate of people
re-offense.
Who are in prison. Right. But it's run into a buzzsaw, not surprisingly, really, in the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. And I suspect on the House side it's going to have even tougher going because there's this ongoing tug of war, if you will, between those who believe that we're being too hard on too many people who are convicted of crimes and those who are worried about letting hardened criminals out of jail. Where do you draw the line?
Protecting their constituents, for example.
Correct.
Is how they would describe
correct.
What they're doing.
And the oddity here is that in past years, the place where a reform package like this would have the most problems and run into roadblocks is in the House Judiciary Committee, a much more conservative panel than their Senate counterpart committee. But this time, it's the Senate committee that has raised all of these questions and essentially tried to slow down the bill so they could take a closer look at it.
Well, Barry, you said a minute ago it's not surprising. I am surprised, and Rachel, I'm counting on you to make it clear to me how this package of bills, which envisions saving $250 million by incarcerating people less, how the Senate it seems to be in the process of amending it to about one ninth its former size. What is changing? What is this new vision of? I mean, it basically means keeping more people in jail longer than the Justice Reinvestment proposal had been.
Well, so there are actually the Senate passed the amended version this morning. They have to do a final vote on it, but so it's. It is amended as it's going to be amended, at least on the Senate side. And one of the major things that changed in it, and there are a lot of things that changed over the course of going through committee, but one of the major things that changed really had to do with parole. And parole and what happens when someone violates parole? Do you send them back for a month? If they violate parole 3 or 4 times, do you send them back for increasing amounts of time? after each violation, you know, 1 year, maybe the next time, 5 years, the next time, 10 years, the next time. And each of those lengths of time costs a lot of money. There were also some changes to medical parole, types of administrative parole. You know, it's there are a lot of different variations in rules that regard, you know, different ways that these, again, we're talking only about nonviolent offenders. This bill does not deal with violent people who have committed violent crimes, only mostly drug offenders.
I want to pull Mark Schindler into this conversation. Mark Schindler is executive director of the Justice Policy Institute, which is a national nonprofit that tries to reduce the use of incarceration. Mark Schindler, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been following this. Well, first of all, tell us, I imagine you're aware more than I am, certainly, of how many states have already passed some kind of justice reinvestment legislation in recent years.
That's right. There's been almost half the states across the country have engaged in a justice reinvestment process, similar to what Maryland is involved in right now. And so, you know, Maryland would not be an outlier by any means in passing the consensus package that was proposed. And as I think as you referenced in the lead-in, this was a really broad bipartisan coalition that worked on this for many, many months with researchers from the Pew Center. And so it's very disappointing. And I think if there are substantial changes, Maryland's really missing an opportunity here.
Well, how would you describe what the opportunity is that you see being missed?
Well, it really is an opportunity to reset how Maryland approaches criminal justice, and quite frankly, to do so based on the best research and evidence out there. And so the package that was created in a bipartisan consensus way, in a full consensus, would have reduced Maryland's prison population and really resulted in a focus just on the most violent offenders needing to be incarcerated and using our resources much more wisely. And so, you know, saving up to, as you said, a $250 million over 10 years and investing that in proven, effective, community-based approaches. So it's really an opportunity to spend our money much more wisely and get better public safety results as well.
Rachel Bay, if the Senate, if the count now is that the bill, as it's leaving the Senate, would instead of saving $250 million over 10 years, would save $34 million over 10 years, does it follow that there will be about $200 million less to invest in services and supports for offenders to keep them from reoffending? Or is it likely, Barry, that the legislature will come up with other money to do this?
I wouldn't put too much faith in the exact numbers that are being thrown out here. How much would be saved 10 years from today is a projection that any economist would really have problems with. At $250 million over 10 years, you're talking about $25 million that you could throw into services for people who are on parole or for drug offenses who are not being sent to jail. We're talking about a state that has a $300 million surplus at the moment. I don't think it's worth discussing too much the dollar value of this, because that's not really what's important. What's important is, are we making sure that the right people are being locked up and that other people who should not be locked up are given alternatives to that? And I think the history of legislation, major legislation like this, in Maryland at least, is that oftentimes it takes more than 1 year. That the General Assembly has to take more than one stab at it before they get it right. So they may move partway toward it this year, and it may not be exactly what the advocates of the justice reform want, not 100%. But I think over a 2-year span, it's likely to succeed.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Here in the studio with me is Barry Raskovar, our political commentator, and Rachel Bay, WIPR's State House reporter. And on the phone with us right now is Mark Schindler, executive director of the Justice Policy Institute. Mark, as we mentioned, you have watched a similar legislative process in I guess, like two dozen other states. Have you seen other states go through the process that Barry just outlined, where they start and pull back and then come back again?
Well, I think that, you know, as Barry said, that does happen, and sometimes these processes and these large bills take more than one session. But I would say more often the case in states that have gone through the justice reinvestment process, they do pass the consensus package. Some have gone farther than Maryland is even considering going at this point on the consensus package. So, you know, I think this is not out of the mainstream, and in fact, many of the states that have proceeded are states that would be considered, you know, by and large, more conservative than Maryland. States like Georgia and Mississippi and other states in the South. I would definitely agree with what Barry was saying in terms of focusing on the money a little bit too much. I mean, that's an important part, obviously, to make sure that we're investing wisely. But I think as important, and as the Baltimore Sun editorialized today, it really is looking at whether the people who are going to prison are there for the right reasons, right? Or whether they're being sent there for arbitrary reasons that don't really consist with what is going to serve public safety. And so that's the really important thing that we should be focused on here. And what the research showed is that Maryland system right now locks up lots of people for long periods of time, and it doesn't serve public safety. So the important thing is to reset the way we're incarcerating, and then we can redirect resources in a more efficient way. I think the other thing that's important to say is this is absolutely a racial justice issue. So we know in Maryland that African Americans are disproportionately impacted by the justice system. Only 30% of the state's population, but more than 70% incarcerated in our state prisons. And so with all the conversation going on nationally and in Maryland this year about the racial disparities within the justice system, I think it's absolutely critical that the state's leaders move forward on this and act in the way that the bipartisan commission recommended they act.
Rachel, when you hear the debate in the House and Senate chambers, is the racial dimension of these legislative proposals part of what is being debated?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You have, in fact, when it came up on the floor, I think it was yesterday, that you actually had members of the Black Caucus say, wait a minute, we need to examine this bill a little closer. We need an extra day or two to do that. Given how much this definitely affects our constituencies and our communities. And the other thing, going back to the point about focusing too much on the savings, is you have to remember the bill, the savings are an end result of what's in the bill. The bill does have specific requirements with regard to sending people to get mental health support and drug abuse support and treatment rather than sending them to prison. So regardless of whether that $250 million savings number gets hit, there are these other provisions in the bill that would start to reduce the prison population regardless.
Another question I have about Barry reminded us that it was the Pew Charitable Trust whose research has generated this justice reinvestment effort in so many states, but particularly in Maryland, it was the governor's Office of Crime Control and Prevention at that time, headed by former Delegate Chris Schenck, who put this package together. Has the governor been lobbying for this package?
Well, I mean, you have Chris Schenck from the governor's office. He's now the deputy chief of staff, was very active during the hearing on this bill, advocating for it. He's been a very active member of very active participant in the discussions on this bill. And he's been in the gallery when the Senate was debating it. There was some discussion last week about whether administrative agencies, whether the governor's agency heads were active in advocating for various bills, but this is not
one of those bills,
where
the legislators think they're missing in action. Mark Schindler, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Mark Schindler is executive director of the Justice Policy Institute. Before we take a break, which we'll need to do in a few minutes, though, there's another set of bills that, in my mind, are conflated with criminal justice, and that is a whole bunch of bills dealing with policing. What is most important to know about those?
Well, so there is one very large bill that also came out of a bipartisan commission, much like the Justice Reinvestment did, and that deals with a number of changes to the very controversial Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. So this bill, it passed the House. It is now going on to the Senate, so it did move forward. And this bill, so one of the very controversial provisions of the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights is this 10-day waiting period that police officers have before they're accused of administrative disciplinary action. Before they have to face any sort of questioning, they are given 10 days to get a lawyer. This bill shortens that to 5. And there are other provisions, increasing civilian involvement in those disciplinary review boards, making disciplinary hearings open to the public, and making it some training changes for police departments around the state. There are some recruitment changes to try to recruit a more diverse class of officers. It's a mega bill. It has a lot of different, more than a dozen different changes that would affect policing. And then there are other bills in addition to that one bill.
What other changes are afoot that would affect policing?
Sure. So there are a couple of Baltimore specific bills. So there's one that offers property tax credits to not just police, but also sheriff's department employees and fire department employees in the city of Baltimore. Who live in Baltimore, trying to encourage them
to encourage public service officers to live
where they serve, yes, and to become parts of the community and become more invested in the community. And then there's another one that makes it easier for civilians to file complaints with the police civilian review board. It removes the requirement that those complaints be notarized, which was seen as a hindrance to a lot of people who want to file complaints. And also it removes, there was a very strict time constraint that they removed to filing those complaints. People have longer to file complaints against for excessive force complaints specifically.
Okay, we need to take another short break here. Rachel Bay, WIPR State House reporter, is going to stay with us, and Barry Raskovar, columnist and commentator, will be here too. I'd like to focus part of our next segment on Baltimore City's Liquor Board. The Senate's Executive Nominations Committee voted not to confirm the Liquor Board members who had been appointed by Governor Hogan. Will the governor appoint new members? Should the power to nominate Liquor Board members be with local jurisdictions? That's something you can join our conversation on, that as well as anything else you'd like to say about what the legislature is doing and how the Democratic legislature is getting along with the Republican governors. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the Maryland General Assembly, which has less than 3 weeks left to do its work, and we're trying to figure out what it's actually going to get done. I'm speaking with political commentator Barry Raskovar of the blog PoliticalMaryland.com, and with Rachel Bay, WIPR State House reporter. And right off the bat, I want to pull into this conversation Becky Witt. She's joining us by phone. She is staff attorney for the Community Law Center, a nonprofit that provides legal services to community organizations in Maryland. She is perhaps better known to radio listeners as the one who writes the Community Law Center's Booze News blog that covers hearings before Baltimore City's Liquor Board. Becky, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So catch us up on what's going on with appointees to the Liquor Board. What has happened? They were expected to be confirmed by the what is it called, Rachel? The Senate Executive Nominations Committee.
Yes.
Right, and it didn't happen.
Well, yes. So they were appointed back in July by the governor, and so they had to be confirmed by this committee. Generally speaking, the committee is pretty much a rubber stamp for the governor's appointees, unless they're, you know, very serious concerns. And we started working with communities to really make sure that the people on that committee understood all the issues that we had with these commissioners, and really directed a lot of they all directed a lot of letters and phone calls at all the members of the committee, and also the whole Baltimore City Senate delegation, to make sure that people understood how the communities felt about the Baltimore City Liquor Board commissioners, which is that they were basically completely ignoring the law. And so, I don't know whether or not they were expected to be confirmed, but the committee voted on Monday not to recommend confirmation. So that goes now to the Senate, the full Senate, for a vote, and they likely will not be confirmed.
Yeah, I was going to ask Rachel how it looks to you. This hasn't gelled yet as a big issue. Barry, do you have a sense of whether?
Well, I think local courtesy here will take effect, and there's no chance that these people will be confirmed by the Senate, at which point then it's in the governor's court, and you have this other bill which is breezing through the legislature, which is really designed to force Governor Hogan's hand to get him to make new appointments to the board. The problem here is, even if this law is passed and Governor Hogan he's pushed against the wall, he's likely to make appointments that may not please everyone. It may be even less pleasing than the current Liquor Board members. We don't know. So it really boils down to a question of whether a Liquor Board is best put together by the mayor or county executive or by the governor.
As I understand it, this legislation, which you say is breezing through, would, if Governor Hogan does not make appointments by the end of the legislature, or by a week after the legislature? By the end of the legislature, then he loses the ability, under this legislation, he would lose ability to make these appointments at all. That power would revert to the mayor and the city council.
Correct. And there's an open question as whether this is a good idea or not. There have been controversies in Baltimore City and in other jurisdictions, especially Anne Arundel County, Baltimore County, that certain council members were getting an undue amount of influence on the Liquor Board for taverns and restaurants in their particular districts that were having problems, so the question is, do you want to remove this political influence from the Liquor Board and give the power to somebody outside the city, such as the governor, or is it best for the mayor and the city council?
Well, is there any reason to believe that if this legislation were to take effect, that were to be passed the legislature, that the governor would sign it? Why would he sign a bill that would strip him of the power? Or do you think he might want to get rid of that power?
Oh, I think he'd love to get rid of this power. This is the type of thing that has been put in the governor's lap that most chief executives in Maryland in the past would say, it's fine with me. It's a problem coming up with people for these types of positions.
Well, Becky Witt of the Community Law Center, this seems clear as mud right now what's actually going to happen. But assuming that things can continue in a state of confusion at the end of the legislature, what happens on the ground here in Baltimore? Do, you know, liquor licenses just continue marching on until there's some clarity?
What's the effect? Well, it's interesting. March, April, and May happen to be the busiest months of the year for the Liquor Board. So it's kind of the worst time of the year for there to be confusion about who's going to be on the board, because the licenses renew as of May 1st every year. So renewal applications are due. Each license is renewed May 1st, so it's May 1st to April 30th. Renewal applications are due in March, and communities can protest the renewal of any license by submitting a petition in March. And generally, the hearings on those protest of renewal petitions are heard in April. The liquor board cannot renew a license that is being protested without a hearing. So if we don't have commissioners during April, we can't have a hearing, and those licensees are not going to get their renewal until there are commissioners. So it really, if let's say the power remains with the governor, if he dilly-dallies on replacing the commissioners, it really only hurts licensees, or it hurts the licensees more than it would hurt the community in that case.
Is there a real potential that significant numbers of liquor licenses in the city of Baltimore would just be suspended?
Well, I don't know about significant. Usually there's between 5 and 10 protests of renewal each year, and that's out of like 1,300 licenses. So it's not a significant percentage by any means, but it's significant to those licensees who won't be able to open as of May 1st if there's no commissioners to hear the protest.
Barry, what's your guess about what happens?
I'm not sure what's going to occur. This is one of these standoffs where the legislature is pulling hard in one direction. The governor is standing firm so far. The day after the legislature ends, April 11th, on April 12th, Governor Hogan could appoint interim new commissioners if he wanted to, if nothing happens before then.
So this is all
clouded in fog at the moment, and it may continue to be that way. But I think the point is here that, it would really be in the best interest for the governor and the legislature to figure out, what path forward, and just march together on it. Otherwise, you could have a lot of confusion, and a number of businesses could be harmed as a result.
Becky Witt, before I let you go, tell me what it is that you hope will come from this exchange that's going on in Annapolis. What to you would be the best outcome?
I'm not sure if I have a firm position on whether the governor or the city should be in charge of appointments. There's pros and cons to both. I guess what I would just say is that there's been so much community frustration with the liquor board for so long, and what was really great about this year is that we were able to channel that frustration into a productive direction and really sent a message to the agency that they have to follow the law, and if they're not going to follow the law, they're not going to be confirmed, and that they work for us. Their mission is to protect public health, safety, and welfare, and they're going to have to answer to the public for what they do. And so that's been really great, and we'll just have to wait and see for who actually ends up in control of appointments going forward.
Well, it's certainly, I appreciate your giving us a sense of what we should be looking for. Becky Witt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Becky Witt is staff attorney for the Community Law Center. We have just a few minutes left. I'd like each of you, Barry and Rachel Bay, to give me a sense of what you think is going to be most important coming out of this legislature. From what we know now, what is something that you think is going to pass that is going to make a difference?
Well, I think the university system of Maryland, the so-called merger bill, which is not really a merger, of the College Park and Baltimore campuses, it's more of a drawing together of the two partners into a firmer partnership arrangement, is something that could have large significance, in large part because the chancellor of the system, who's now Bob Corrett, would, under this bill, have his headquarters, his offices, in Baltimore at the Columbus Center, and along with it about 80 to 100 staff members would come up here. Overnight,
Now the headquarters are in Adelphi, in the Washington suburbs.
Yes, in the Washington suburbs. It would basically shift central offices for this college system to Baltimore, and it would make Bob Corrett a very important figure in the business community, in the Greater Baltimore Committee, and other organizations overnight. I think it would really increase the spotlight on Baltimore higher education And it's something that I think goes along with the rest of this Baltimore package that we've talked about earlier in the show.
And Rachel, what do you think is going to be the piece of legislation that will pass that will have the most impact, excepting, of course, the budget, which is necessary for the functioning of the state government?
Well, I think a lot of these criminal justice and police issues are very big, and I think collectively it's unclear which of the specific measures are going to make it out on the other side, but you know, I think collectively they are going to have a significant impact, especially in Baltimore. And it is worth noting that a lot of this attention on Baltimore came out of what happened last April here. Legislators have said so explicitly that they all of a sudden started paying attention to a lot of these longstanding issues. And I think, you know, those police efforts and the criminal justice efforts are in some part, maybe not intentionally, but in some part addressing some of those concerns that the legislators started to pay attention to following April's riots.
We have just a couple minutes left, and so I want to turn to something which two changes which are symbolic and therefore perhaps not what will cannot be said to have much impact. One is they're debating what the official interpretation of the state motto is. Can mm-hmm. you catch us up on that, Rachel?
Sure. So the Italian, they basically are debating whether the Italian is sexist, whether it, because the, and forgive me, the current motto is manly deeds, womanly words, or the current interpretation of it. And they want to change just the translation without changing the original text to,
firm deeds, gentle words? I know,
right.
It's gentle words is the back.
Yeah.
So we're fighting over the interpretation. The other thing that they've done this already, right, is change part of the state song.
Right. So the Senate has passed, and now it has to go through the House. A bill that takes out all of the current state song except for just the third verse, which is seen as pretty innocuous, and keeps that third verse in the tune and adds to it the fourth verse of a poem also called Maryland by Maryland, but written a little bit later, that celebrates Maryland's natural beauties as opposed to the current one, which has a lot of Confederate sentiments.
So, Barry, you're not rolling your eyes, but
that's correct. I mean, the current song is really anti-unionist, pro-Confederate. You're talking about someone who is really upset by the start of the Civil War, and it really has no place today in our society.
So, you think this is worth doing? It's worth the legislature's time.
Yes, it's not something that was written in stone, and we're modifying it, to adjust to society today.
Well, I appreciate you're both walking us through what the legislature is up to and giving us some sense of what we should be looking at. We'll ask you back after they've actually done it. Barry Raskovar, political commentator of the blog PoliticalMaryland.com, and Rachel Bay, State House reporter for WYPR. We also spoke with Becky Witt, staff attorney for the Community Law Center, a nonprofit that provides legal resources to community organizations, and Mark Schindler, executive director of the Justice Policy Institute. Lunch for our midday guests provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to dissect the student debt crisis. Is college still worth it? What can students do to make informed choices about where they go to school and how much debt they take on? If you feel buried by your student loans, how can you begin to dig yourself out? That's tomorrow on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.